Hello, this is Chris Shiflett, and on today's podcast, I'm going to be talking to John Doe from X. But first, here's my fancy theme music.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor. Walking the floor over you.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to episode number 2 of Walking the Floor with me, your old pal, Chris Shiflett. How you doing out there? I'm excited today because I'm going to be talking to Mr. John Doe from X and the Knitters and fucking Roadhouse, among other things. I'm a huge John Doe fan. Huge John Doe fan. So you'll see when we get to the interview, it was a little rough talking to him because the internet decided not to work at my house, and I was doing the interview with him via Skype, and I wound up dropping the call like a million times. And as cool as he was, it eventually just kind of killed the interview. But we had a good talk anyway, and got to talk about some cool stuff. I didn't get to talk to him about some of the stuff I wanted to talk to him about, like his solo work. We didn't really get much into that, but we did talk about X and horses and acting and some cool stuff. But before we get to that, let me remind you that Dead Peasants are hitting the road in November with our label mates, Reverend Peyton's Big Damn Band. We're going to be honky-tonking all the way from Seattle to San Diego and pretty much everywhere in between. So make sure to come out and see us, because it's probably going to be the last thing we do for a little while, because I'm going to be busy with Foos right after that. Real, real busy. And I don't think we're going to be doing a whole lot of Dead Peasants shows for a little while after that. Maybe here and there, but not too many. So that's all up and down the West Coast. All right, let's get to today's interview. John Doe, musician, singer, songwriter, poet, actor, equestrian. That's right. I said equestrian. I'm here to tell you that John Doe is a real deal, horseback riding, badass punk rock cowboy. And if you don't believe me, then go to his website at thejohndoe.com and check out the video clip of him riding around on his horse. I was kind of blown away, so that was the first thing I asked him about. Check it out. You know, I don't know you, but I always imagined you to be like this urban, East Side Los Angeles kind of dude. So I guess my question is horseback riding a case of your cultural and musical interests influencing your life, or is this something you grew up with?
I think it's just good luck. No, I didn't grow up with it, but I think it's something that it's something that's a great lesson to learn. And that lesson is do things that you learn things that you wouldn't expect you would learn, like later in life. I didn't start riding horses until my friend Michael Blake, who wrote Dances with Wolves, said, "Oh, I've got this horse out in out at the stables by Magic Mountain." This is sort of a long story, so.
That's okay. We got all the time in the world.
Yeah. Well, I don't have all the time. Maybe you do. I don't think you do, really. I think you're saying that. But anyway, so he said, "Yeah, I want you to come out and ride with me sometime." I said, "Sure." I was probably, 30. And said, "Sure." And then, you know, bit by bit, you just I kind of lost track or lost the ability to be able to do that, you know, just where I lived and what I was doing, maybe 8 years ago, 9 years ago,
mm-hmm.
And but in between times, I lived outside of L.A. and owned horses that were on our property and everything like that. So it just it goes to show you, if you keep your life expanding, then you can then you can live fuller, I think a fuller and longer life. And if you start letting your life contract, then it's going to be less happy, less satisfied, less of everything. But I'm not nearly as knowledgeable as many other people.
Right.
I just know that, I do use a few of the, you know, natural horsemanship techniques where you give the horse the idea that, or you make the horse think that it's his idea or her idea to do what you want them to do.
That seems like a good lesson for being a band leader, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you don't want to beat anybody up. I don't.
Sure.
I mean, there's a few people I'd like to beat up, like in the government. I would love to, you know, give John Boehner a fucking crack in the teeth. However,
wouldn't we all? Wouldn't we all?
So yeah, I mean, I was out of L.A. in 1989.
Oh, really? You've been out of here that long?
Oh yeah. I lived up on the Grapevine for about 20 years.
Yeah, is that right about the time that X broke up the first time? Or did you guys actually break up, or did you just go on hiatus? Or I'm not
sort of hiatus. I mean, you know, there was a maybe 4 months where when Billy left that we all stood around going, "Holy shit!" And that was in '86, I think. Right after Ain't Love Grand had you know, finished its album cycle,
right,
and yeah, that was a little bit of a, you know, took the wind out of our sails a little bit, and then Dave Alvin and us had been doing a bunch of work together, so we said, "Hey Dave, you're kind of unhappy in the Blasters. How about playing in X?" And he rose to the challenge and realized, "Oh my God, we've got some big shoes to fill." And then Tony Gilkison came in, and we did that one record. And after we finished that record, Dave said, "You know, everybody else has been singing my songs, and maybe I should sing my songs." So Tony soldiered on, and we played with Tony for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years.
Right.
And it was great. And then, I think maybe in 94, 95, something like that, Exene and I were talking and said, "You know, we really should. We're much better at playing punk rock than we are playing alt country." So,
do you still think that today?
Yes.
Really?
I think that X is better at playing punk rock than alt country.
Right.
Yeah. I think that what X did for the first 3 or 4 records was really original and a great hybrid and you know, it's like nobody else, and I'm happy and proud for that and happy for that and proud of it. But so anyway, we talked to Tony and said, "Hey, you know what, we think we should play punk rock and not try to be, you know, alternative or something." And he said, "You know, I'm not really into that." And so that's the only time that X really broke up. That was maybe 95, 96.
So that was after Jesus?
Yes.
Okay.
And, you know, if Jesus had done really well, I'm sure that we maybe would have thought, we do have a second or a third act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being, so maybe see how we are being our second act and with Dave and Tony.
When did you start making solo records?
After Billy left. After Billy, 87, 88. I think Meet John Doe was out in maybe 89 or 90, something like that.
So if X had made a decision to focus more on punk rock, did you feel like your solo records were more of an outlet for your country side?
Yeah.
Or your Americana kind of side?
Yeah. You know, like a lot of people, I just, someone gave me an opportunity, and I took it. You know, someone at Geffen Records said, "Here's, you know, we'd like to make a solo record, and we'll we won't get in the way too much, which was a lie. That's okay. I went along willingly. But you know, here's some money, and here's you know, I mean, here's quite a bit of money actually, and we believe that you can do this. And you know, I had been more interested in you know, a variety of songwriting at that point. So yeah, why not? Just like you know, someone, Allison Anders, saying, hey, you know, I'm making a movie in Los Angeles, and it's got a bunch of your other friends that are acting in it. You want to try it? And I said, sure. I mean, why wouldn't you?
Was that your first foray into acting, or was acting something that you'd worked on before?
No, I hadn't worked on it, no. But I always loved the movies, but that doesn't mean you can be in them.
Sure.
You know, unless you kind of, you know, then unless you have the opportunity. And then afterwards I did some study and some work on it and things like that. Learning, you know, on the job training. Yeah, kind of like a plumber's assistant.
And how does that work for you now? Like, you seem like you've got this great life or career in music and the arts, where it seems like, to me, from an outsider looking in, you bounce between different things. I guess my question is, what's a year in the life of John Doe like? Like, well, how do you figure out, you know, I'm going to act in this movie, I'm going to do this solo record, I'm going to do this tour, we're going to do these X shows? It seems like you've got a lot of different outlets and interests.
You know, whichever comes first. And then if something is an incredible opportunity, you figure out if you can get out of the other commitments that you have, and not piss anybody off. An example would have been when was it? 2011? Yeah. 2011, I was about to, Yep Rock was releasing the last solo record. Mm-hmm. And maybe 3 months before, Pearl Jam called and called our management and said, "Hey, you want to go to South America?" And I said, "Oh no, I've worked, you know, 4 years on making this record. I can't do that, because I would be." Untrue. I wouldn't be loyal to the record. I would be bailing at the moment when it's about to take off.
Sure.
And then I realized what an opportunity it was, and how much money I would make, and all those things. And go to South America with Pearl Jam. Okay, yeah.
Was that X going to South America? Or was that you going solo?
No, X. X played with Pearl Jam in South America and also in Europe, but. You know, then Yep Rock was nice enough to say, "Well, look, we'll try to, you know, release it and keep it going." And then I went from literally from Mexico City to Chicago to start from, you know, finishing the X tour to doing a solo tour.
Was that your guys' first time down there, or has X toured South America?
No, it was first time, and it was incredible, just truly mind blowing. And of course, we had the good fortune to be in the Pearl Jam bubble, mm-hmm. Stay in really nice hotels, not have to, you know, worry about transportation and things like that.
When back when X was first starting out and first putting records out, did you guys tour a lot internationally, or were you mostly touring in the States? Like, what was your touring life like back then?
It was really slim. Maybe by Ain't Love Grand or More Fun in the New World. I mean, Ain't Love Grand was the most successful, maybe the least representative, and you know, you can argue that it wasn't as original or as good a songs, but it was the most successful record, and we toured probably off and on maybe for 6 months on that record.
Really? That's it?
Yeah, maybe. Not even that much.
That's fascinating, because I would imagine you guys just touring always.
The first four records, we'd make a record, we'd tour for made like one time around the country, do some other, you know, dates here and there, and that would be it. We'd tour for maybe 2 months, and then it would be like, okay, write another record, do it again, and which was fine. I mean,
Okay, so that was my first dropped call, and I was pretty much in full panic mode at this point because I just hung up on John Doe. Whoops. But I called him back right away, and he was cool, and we jumped right back into it. Check it out.
The short version of that is the punk rock network, the alternative music network was not established by then.
Right.
It wasn't until, you know, maybe the mid-80s that it, you know, when all the SST bands had been touring like crazy, or you know, the Replacements and that sort of the second wave had gone through.
Right.
And we weren't going to sleep on anybody's fucking floor. No thanks. That's for fucking hippies. No, we're going to go out and make money and not go back and, you know, I mean, I suppose if people were smarter then, you know, if the agent would have said, look, there's a way that we can, you know, do something other than just the, you know, rubber stamp of go to this club, go to that club, blah, blah.
Right.
Sure, we could have done more, but whatever. We did what we did.
Did you guys ever get on like a big arena tour opening up for somebody, or did you ever
Never.
Have any of those experiences?
The first time we opened for somebody on a real tour was with Pearl Jam, because they're the only fucking band that's brave enough to have X open for them, because they know that they can go out there and kick ass in their own right, and everybody else is chicken.
You know, the first time...
I mean, you know, the Red Hot Chili Peppers... say, oh, X was such a great influence on us, and we owe them so much, because they opened for us, I don't know, half a dozen times at,
sure.
at big shows and stuff. They called us once, and then we asked for a reasonable fee, and they said, oh, no, we don't think we can handle that. So fuck them, you know. Fuck them and all their phony baloney, yeah, they're so cool, we love them. It's like, yeah. You don't. And nobody else was man enough or woman enough to let us open for them. You know?
Well, you know, going back a ways, what was it like in the early days of the L.A. punk rock scene? You know, did you guys feel like you were part of a community of bands?
Absolutely. The only way that the L.A. punk rock scene survived was by working together. And we were really kind of shocked at how competitive the New York bands were with each other.
Really?
I don't think the first wave as much. I think, like, you know, Talking Heads and Ramones and Blondie and Television and the Heartbreakers and Richard Hell. I mean, I think they had a bit more, and Patti Smith had a bit more of community feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But the second wave with, you know, like Lydia Lunch, Teenage Jesus, and who are some other bands? Mars and... They're really competitive. But the L.A. punk rock scene was very community-minded, because everybody had to work together to maintain, you know, like what little we could scratch out of it. But nobody thought, oh, dude, this is going to be so influential in 15 years, dude.
So
nobody had that, you know, pretense. Nobody had that sort of like, this is going to be important,
right?
Because we felt like it could be going away in a moment, you know, that it could last 6 months. You know, sort of like the England scene seemed to kind of come and go pretty quickly.
And did you guys feel a kinship with some of the, like, the New York bands, the English bands, like or San Francisco bands, like some of the other scenes from other places?
Yeah. I would say more New York than London, but that's just me.
Right.
The Damned toured quite a bit and came to L.A. quite a bit. and But the Ramones and Blondie and Talking Heads so much. Television, they all came to the Whiskey. So several times early on. So.
And what were you doing before X? I mean, how did you get into music? What were your early musical moments? Did it come out of your family or?
Both my parents played, but they didn't really encourage me. I just kind of picked it up, and I was part of a generation that saw, you know, I was in grade school when the Beatles and Rolling Stones came out, so I was like, oh, that looks like a good job. I like that idea. So, and then, you know, I was a teenager when all the psychedelic music was happening, and so it was like, wow, and Motown and stuff like that. So bass seemed like it was easier, and I think it is.
was that your first guitar. Instrument?
Yeah. Well, no, I had piano lessons when I was a kid, which didn't really take, but it did teach me, you know, what the notes are.
Right.
Yeah, so.
Did you grow up here in L.A.?
No, I was in Baltimore.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, yeah, I moved here in 75. The end of 75.
Did you come out here with a band?
No, just came out with a friend. And then he went back to Baltimore, and so I was kind of left on my own, and I met Xane early on, maybe like a couple of months, because I was, I'd run a poetry workshop in Baltimore. And so I went to one in Venice that some fairly well-known people, Charles Bukowski, had been there, and so had Tom Waits. And so I figured this was a good way to meet other artists. And Xane went like the same first day that I went, because she was working there. But yeah, I had played in a bunch of shitty bands and didn't really understand why I didn't fit in, because I, you know. But I would say the earliest musical influences was folk music, and then I really patterned a lot of my bass playing after Rick Danko from the band. Mm. I learned a lot from listening to his records and Chuck Berry, like Willie Dixon, and I listened to a lot of blues records, Chicago blues records. That's kind of how I learned to play.
And what about country? When did you get into country?
Yeah, I mean, Hank Williams. I liked him a lot, maybe when I was 19 or 20. Right? I first really started listening to him. But it was maybe developed a little later, maybe when Xane and I were together and we were going to thrift stores and finding George Jones and Tammy Wynette records and Loretta Lynn, because you could find, you know, old records for 50 cents or something like that.
Right.
And there's a lot of similarity, you know, lyrically, and you know, kind of the drama of drinking and fighting and lying and cheating. You know, there's similarities between that and punk rock, the honesty and simplicity. So I think that's why we were drawn to it.
Yeah, it seems like there's like this kinship between punk rock and like old honky tonk.
Yeah. I think probably the old honky-tonks, like in Bakersfield, were a lot more dangerous than any punk rock club. I think that if you're working in an oil field and you're not afraid to go get your gun and actually shoot somebody, whereas punk rock, it's a little more like you get a black eye.
I just interviewed Tommy Hayes and Red Simpson up in Bakersfield a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And they were telling me some crazy stories about what that scene was like, you know, in the 50s and 60s when it was all kind of going off. And it sounded pretty intense.
Yeah. Yeah, I lived in, I saw Red several times. I lived in Bakersfield for about 3 years. And, yeah. Yeah, everybody would say, oh, God, don't go to the blackboard.
Right.
We'll get beat up.
Right.
Bad people go there.
Was that? Oh, did the blackboard still exist when you moved up there?
No. I just heard stories.
Right.
I saw Red at Trout's a few times, you know, go to the, I had a little period of going to those bars up in Oildale where
sure.
I lived. Yeah, it's good. It's a good, it's unbearably hot, but it's an interesting place.
Yeah. It seems well kept to me. I mean, it's sad that none of those old clubs exist anymore, but like when you're driving around downtown Bakersfield, it's got that like, you know, American graffiti feel to it that,
yeah.
It's kind of
nice. Did you go up to Oildale?
I did. I actually went to Trout's one night a couple years ago and checked it out. And it was, you know, on one hand, it's totally cool. But it was like, you know, there's nobody there and there's a couple people line dancing and, you know, a drum machine. And it was just it was not quite the glorious honky-tonk experience that I was hoping for.
Well, you got to go on the weekend.
I just picked the wrong night.
Yeah, but there's a lot of great bars in Oildale. Oildale's the place to go.
Oh, really?
Downtown is so-so, but Oildale's. If you want to go to bars in Bakersfield, go to Oildale. There's the Tejon Club is real good, and Chops is okay, but there's a place right up the street called the Long Branch, which has got a really like the Long Bar. It's on the sign. And yeah, there's some. You can definitely.
Okay, that was the second time I dropped a call on John Doe right there, and at this point, I just wanted to fucking crawl under a rock and die. I was so ashamed of my lousy computing skills and my complete lack of professionalism that I just figured, I'm going to call John Doe again right now, and he's just going to tell me to go fuck myself because I'm wasting his time. But alas, he did not. He agreed to keep going for a little while longer. So here you go. If I could ask you one more thing, if that's cool. I'm just wondering about songwriting. Like, well, I'm just curious as to what your process is.
Well, if I could tell you what that was, I would be writing songs all the time. But no, I don't write all the time. I think that's kind of a fallacy when people say, "Oh yeah, you know, like I had, you know, 50 songs to choose from for this record," and I think, well, what did you do? Pick all the crappy ones? Because it's not an incredible record,
right?
You know?
Right.
And I think, you know, there are some people that are really prolific for a short period of time, and I think it's best to write songs when you're truly inspired.
How do you get inspired?
Jesus. A little baby Jesus.
Oh, nice.
It's out of necessity. It's the necessity of you know, kind of looking at the calendar and thinking, holy shit, I should.
Yep. Holy shit. I couldn't have said it better myself. That was the third time I dropped the call in the middle of my John Doe interview. So at that point, I just threw my hands in the air and said, fuck it, I give up. It's just not going to work. And he had already been so cool at that point, and I just kept dropping the call and calling him back, and he just kept, you know, letting me talk to him, but I just didn't want to bug the poor guy anymore. I'm sure he had better things to do. So I emailed him just to say, sorry, man, that didn't work and whatever. And he emailed me right back, actually, because he was in the middle of answering a question about songwriting, and I thought that was really cool. Here's what he wrote to me. He said, sorry we didn't get to finish that songwriting question. To be honest, the whole process is still a mystery that I don't care to unravel. Inspiration happens in so many ways, it's impossible to say, this is my process. So there you go. Wise words. What a cool guy. John Doe. Check out his website, The John Doe. That's the THEE, JohnDoe.com, for all your John Doe information, tour dates, and whatever. And that's that. Next week, I'm going to have Nick Arson from The Hives on the show. We had a great conversation while he was standing in a field somewhere in Paris, I think. And if you haven't already done so, remember, go check out the latest Dead Peasants record, All Hat and No Cattle. It's out now on Side One Dummy Records. And we will be touring the West Coast in November with Reverend Peyton's Big Damn Band. So in the meantime, adios. I'll see you next week.